just take a minute and reflect on our motivation. Place it squarely within the context of benefiting sentient beings through progressing on the path to enlightenment, gaining wisdom and knowledge and skill to use while we're on the path and after we've completed it, so that we can make a good contribution that really is of effective service and benefit to all the sentient beings upon whom we depend simply to stay alive. Questions, and I can refer them to Guy.
about the qualm with the Kalupas about adding inherent existence in, about the horn.
Yeah.
I understand the analogy, but what I don't understand is maybe this is because they have, because the Kalupas say true existence, inherent existence, all these things are synonyms, and the other people don't, but if they already believe in inherent existence, how would you be adding something in?
Well, I think the idea is that we perceive things as inherently existent, mm-hmm. and not only, you know, the appearance of inherent existence, but we grasp onto that appearance. And we don't even know that we're doing it. Mm-hmm. So, saying we're negating inherent existence, we're not really understanding what it is, or if we understand, it seems like this extra thing that we're tacking on to phenomena. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, we're not using the analysis, the reasoning process that gets to emptiness, to really question how things appear to us and how we apprehend them as existing. So it's in that way that, oh, inherent existence, yeah, it doesn't exist. Because it sounds like we're just putting that on top and then saying, but it doesn't exist anyway. Mm-hmm. But we're not questioning what is there that we're putting it on top of. Mm-hmm. In other words, we're keeping our ordinary appearance exactly as it is, mm-hmm. not questioning it at all. And, you know, negating something else. So Chankya, he's quite hard on that. There was a, you know, a very beautiful verse. I can't recall it now, of course, but where he really hammers at that. You know, that we're leaving everything alone that we perceive, and negating some monster that's in the distance. Okay. And so the question that Guy raised, you know, are we searching for inherent existence, or are we searching for the object, you know? And I was talking with Thupten Jinpa when I saw him about this, because so often in my teachers have said, you know, you identify the object of negation, and then which is inherent existence, and then you search for it. And Jinpa said that's not actually how Tsongkhapa explains it. You know, it's not wrong, but it's not actually as it's explained, which is what we're trying to do is question how does the object exist. Okay, in other words, here I am, how I appear to myself, how I think of myself, but how do I really exist? Do I exist in the way that I appear to myself to exist? Does the tablecloth exist in the way it appears to me to exist. And that when you question that way, you know, then you say, then you see, well, it can't exist from its own side. You know, the only way it can possibly exist is dependent on other factors. So if it's dependent on other factors, if that's how it really exists, that is actually very contradictory to the way it appears to me, because, I mean, this is a book. In and of itself, out there, every jerk knows it, independent of my mind. Okay, but if I really meditate strongly that this book is dependent on causes and conditions and parts, and especially on the mind that conceives and labels it, and especially in relationship to other things, then that doesn't match how it appears. Okay? So the idea is, when we're meditating on emptiness, we really have to look at the way things, the way we apprehend things, and the way they appear to us, and see that that's wrong. You know? And Jeffrey talks about, you have to, like, feel like, if this didn't exist, what does? You know, if this is not a book, you know, if this is not a book, what in the world is a book? What in the world is here if there's not a book here? And you have to have that appearing to your mind, you know. And then you search, if there's a book, how does this book exist? Is there really a book here? And then, oh, there's no book. Okay, but when we say there's no book, what we're meaning is there's no book as it is appearing to me. You know, there's no book as I'm apprehending it. You're laughing. Am I making a mistake?
No, you got it exactly right. No, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, there's no book such as could be found when searched for with the question, what is this book really?
Yeah.
And so when you... that's what I think, you know, that when you, that even though you identify the object of negation, and you find, in the case of, you know, the person, that it's not the mere person, but this inherently existent person, then, you know, as you say, you search for the person as it appears to you, mm-hmm. and not for just some merely existent person. And that idea is that, you know, that it shreds the way we ordinarily see the world, rather than leaving it unscathed, because it means that the way that we really think that things exist doesn't exist that way at all.
Yeah. And our analysis has to poke holes in that. If it doesn't poke holes in it, then, you know, it's not being effective. I was thinking, you know, when people die, it's a very good chance to meditate on emptiness. And I was thinking about this, you know, in terms of little Manjushri, because Manjushri seems so real. I mean, he was our kiddie for 18 years, and, you know, and he has his own personality. He wasn't like Achala. He's not like Maitri. He has his own personality, you know, and his own habits, and he's really there, and we saw him every day. And now, you know, the body is there, and you look at the body, and you're kind of waiting for Manjushri to wake up, you know, and kind of step out of his basket and walk 3 steps so you can pet him, and then walk another 3 steps so you can follow after him and pet him some more. Right? Yeah, that's his habit. And, you know, and he's not doing that. So what, you know, how did I think Manjushri existed? Yeah, how did I think he existed? Because all those years, you know, it appears there's a person in there. A person doesn't have to mean human being. But, you know, there's a person in there. There's a living being there with his own unique personality. Somewhere inside that body. I don't analyze and figure out where. That's not relevant, but it's just somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. And that makes his body move, and, you know, that's who he is. Yeah. But then how does Manjushri really exist? You know, if there were some real person in there, there still should be a real person in there. Either that, or if it left, I should be able to find this real person zooming around the house or, you know, doing something else. But, you know, you can't. You can't. There was a body and there was mind. And that's all. And nothing else beside that. But it feels like, there's a body, there's a mind, and there's something else that's Manjushri that makes the body and mind work. You know, that hooks the body and mind and makes them work, collaborate together, you know? And that controls the body and mind. But what is it?
Would you contrast that you said when you asked, it was
Jinpa.
We identify the object being negated, and then we...
Then we ask, how does that object... We identify what a truly existent book appears to us to be, how we apprehend it, how our, you know, the object that ignorance is apprehending. But, and then we question, but how does the book really exist? In other words, it's an investigation of how something actually exists.
Not whether or not it exists, but how does it exist?
Yeah.
Okay, so when you posed the question to him, that wasn't how you said it.
No, my question to him was, I had always heard it, that you identify the object of negation and then you search for it within the basis.
I see. Okay.
You know? And he said, that's not wrong, but that's not exactly how Tsongkhapa explained it. And he said the problem with doing it that way is that sometimes it seems like, you know, we're adding on the inherent existence and then we're taking it away, but the book is still exact. It doesn't challenge at all how we relate to this thing or how, you know, what we think this thing is. Yeah. Yeah.
And the distinction that, or the criticism that other people make of the using the qualifier inherent existence, could we say that it's just that Tsongkhapa was being like super literal and that the other people are just not as literal in their terminology?
I don't know if it's a thing of literal as it is precise. You know, Tsongkhapa is very precise about things. Yeah, but if you look in the perfection of wisdom, when they say no eye, no ear, no nose, you know, I mean, aside from it being inconvenient to say no inherently exists an eye, no inherently exists an ear, the reason it said no, no, no like that is because that shocks us. It's getting across the idea that what we think is there is not there. I think an inherently existent book is here. It's not there. That doesn't mean that a conventionally existent book isn't there. Okay? But I think there's an inherently existent one, and that's not there at all. So saying, you know, so the eye, the ear, the same for all of those things. Yeah?
So if you do the four-point analysis or the seven-point analysis, and you usually the first step is you identify the objects of negation. So
right.
With that alternate statement, would you start differently?
No. You still have to, you know, really get it in your mind about, well, how do I think? Right now, my ordinary mind, how does this appear to exist? And not just reciting to ourselves, it exists and it appears to exist independent of causes, it appears to exist independent of mind. You know, not like that, but like, okay, how I ordinarily perceive it. What does it look like? Well, for me, you know, one big thing is it's out there. It's out there. And it's quite distinct from my mind. And it's exists out there exactly as it appears to me, even when I'm not looking at it, when nobody else is looking at it, regardless of language, regardless of conceptuality, it exists out there objectively. Doesn't it? Yeah? And so that's identifying the object of negation. And then you question, well, how does this book really exist?
The sense is that then, at that point, when you say, how does this book exist, it carries the force of your understanding of this book as this, a book which seems to vividly to my mind to be objectively there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's done the object of negation identification first.
Yeah. So how does this exist? If it existed out there the way it appears to me, what would happen?
You could find a book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I can find the book. It's right here. But that's the kind of finding we're meaning. You know, you could find it. Everybody would see it exactly the same way.
It's just some causes and conditions that created the book.
Yeah. But when we look at that, you know, I mean, when you look at this, do you think this was created by causes and conditions? Do you think of the people who typeset it and the people who did the prayers and the people who did the layout? Do you think of the paper and the ink and stuff like that? I don't. It's a book.
Not much. All those books, I think of that. These particular books, I think of that.
Yeah. But, you know, we don't think that this... Oh, I find it quite helpful to think this only exists because the causes and conditions for it exist. It's the only reason this exists. But that's not the way it appears to me. It doesn't appear to me as if it only exists because it has causes and conditions. It appears to me as if it is out there.
On its own. And it seems
complete.
Unchanging.
Yeah.
Unchanging.
Totally unchanging.
The same every day for 100 years.
Yeah.
Is how it seems to me if I don't think of it.
Right.
I was just going to make a note of your changes in your wording on the dedications and so forth.
Uh-huh.
You know, to me it's like, I'm so aware things are always changing, you know. And how aware I got when I came here and you're saying things the correct way and you're taking out things and changing words, and it's like, those things were set in stone in my brain.
Yeah.
It just reminded me of how everything changes.
Right. Yeah.
When Guy started talking about the like fly that has, you know, a different world, but not really a different world, and that, you know, when we start really understanding this analysis, that we can start to understand that emptiness of things, and see that clearly. I don't understand how emptiness wouldn't necessarily lead to bodhicitta. And also, how it could be that one could understand emptiness without having bodhicitta. If you understand that there's a fly over there that's experiencing a completely different world than you and, you know, suffering, how would you not have bodhicitta arise in your mind with that understanding?
Well, you could certainly have compassion for the fly who's under the influence of ignorance, but you yourself don't take responsibility for doing anything about it. You say, oh, it's really too bad that fly's under the influence of ignorance and cycling in samsara. But there's nothing much I can do, and I don't want to really do too much because I got to get myself out of samsara. So, you know, arhats have much more compassion than we do. There's this misnomer that arhats are these selfish people, you know, like Gaddafi or somebody. No, arhats have much more compassion than we do. Much more compassion. But their compassion doesn't get to the point where they're willing to say, I'm going to jump in the ocean and rescue these people. They stand by the, you know, they're not the lifeguard who jumps in the ocean and drags the drowning person out. They're the people like me who stand on the ocean and go, oh no, somebody's drowning. I don't know what to do. You know how to swim. Jump in and save them. Okay? So it's like that. But what I find so interesting is, you know, this the difference between Dapolpa and Tsongkhapa regarding, you know, compassion is that Dapolpa would say the compassion is already there, the great compassion's already there, you just need to, you know, kind of realize something. And then it you know, comes out. Whereas, like, His Holiness really emphasizes that compassion needs to be specifically cultivated, you know? Although there was something that in, was it one of Nagarjuna's writings, was it The Great Expanse or something like that, where it kind of makes it look like, do you remember? It kind of makes it look like that if you realize emptiness, you would automatically have compassion. You know, there's one of the works attributed to Nagarjuna, which, you know, the Tibetans consider he wrote, but there's some doubt about it from other people, makes it look like that. But His Holiness usually says that compassion needs to be specifically cultivated. I can't remember if it was that or Essay on Enlightenment.
Yeah, it might be either one of the hymns or the Essay on the Mind of Enlightenment.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I've thought about that, and actually, there's been stuff written about it that's outside the specific context of you know, Gelugpa doctrine, and just on the question of, like, because people talk so much about interconnectedness and that whether that's the basis for ethical values, and if we really understood how interconnected things were, then would that, you know, and if you think of, like, well, if you really just see the other person as not other, but you see how truly intimately interconnected you are, and this is just at the level of understanding dependent arising, then would that not spontaneously induce? I think that's the idea. It seems that there's a really strong idea that that's extremely helpful and powerful way to develop great compassion, but at the same time saying that you can't have the kind of compassion that you need, just expect it to come automatically. You can't expect the whole method side, in effect, to just take care of itself if you get the if the view side correct, and that you have to cultivate factors in, the, in terms of your, what do you say, sensitivity, or how much you care. As I like the lifeguard example. It's like, you know that this person is not disconnected from you, but still there's this, what, sort of subtle unwillingness to say, oh, I understand that I'm connected to this, but then am I willing really to put my life at risk in order to do something about it? If you just think about it, it's like people can have understandings of how things are connected and then actually misuse those understandings to manipulate and harm others. If you go the other way and say, oh yeah, I have a deep understanding, like Machiavellian, right? I really see how what's going on there. Karl Rove. You know, it's like, hey, what's the button to push to make sure it all goes red, you know? Yeah. And it's like he has this deep understanding of how things are connected.
Right?
Yeah.
So we have
advertising, right? Yeah. How the human mind works.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of scientific.
You get power from seeing that, but then how do you use it?
But is that a good analogy with understanding the nature of reality? I mean, to me, it just seems like there's a distinction. If I just understand the mind, you know, the way the human mind might function, to me, that's a completely different world than what I'm thinking.
What the
process? Exactly. That's kind of giving me an insight, not so much how I might manipulate things, but that I'm connected in a way that's beyond that.
You know, I see your point.
I mean,
you think it would lessen your self-grasping. Like in the lifeguard example, it's like, well, why are you so attached to your own life since you know that it's not inherently your life, you know, and so forth, right? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I keep going back and forth on that. Sometimes I thought that it, like, really deep attention in the sense of really knowing what's happening at every level, mm-hmm. that you could, in some sense, argue, well, that's all that it would take, that everything else would follow from that if you really just saw things as they were. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that's definitely not the mainline teaching.
Because I even think in that sense, you know, at just a conventional level, making a heartfelt connection with somebody else, really understand, even if it's a different, you know, somebody with a very different view, mm-hmm. when I can really, like you said, step out of my own preconceived view of the world, of that person, mm-hmm. get to know them, that it automatically brings a certain closeness as opposed to how I might manipulate that person. I mean, you know, if my intent really is to get to know them better, you know, so that I understand that, but doing that is just, you know, I don't see that it gets to me to a point. I mean, in theory, it could. The whole point of wanting to do that is so that I really,
yeah,
but can just feel closer and feel that heartfelt connection, which doesn't mean that I want to say, how can I get their money or get them to buy my products or.
But that goes to your motivation.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not to your understanding. It's your motivation for seeking that understanding.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
I wonder if Milarepa had realized emptiness when he was doing his black magic. And, mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't seem like he had. I mean, it's difficult to realize emptiness when you have so much affliction manifest in your mind. Because
right.
emptiness is the antidote to affliction. So I don't think that's the case. Yeah. But something to distinguish here is that self-grasping ignorance and self-centered mind are different. Yeah, so they have to be, you know, like understanding interdependence is very helpful with both of them, but they also have their own particular antidotes that we have mm-hmm. to apply. Yeah. Otherwise, when we got rid of the self-grasping ignorance, the self-centered mind would be gone too, and all our huts would have been be Buddhas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Y'all jump in the ocean.
Right. Yeah, this is the whole way that sometimes you find people talking about the difference between the traditions is I find really very distasteful. You know, like, oh, all these Theravada people, they're just interested in themselves, they're arhats, they don't care about anybody. That's totally wrong. Totally wrong. So we shouldn't carry on that tradition. Another question? Oh, okay.
So, Kinzer Dampatekto explained this to us, and Guy did also, but I think I need you to explain it. That it's, let me see if I can even say it. Tsongkhapa kind of has a different take on terms of how we apprehend objects. And you've talked about this. Sometimes we're just doing this kind of lightly. We're just walking, and it's just that light thing that he says is kind of, well, what you said one time was non-dual, but that didn't make sense to me yesterday. I'm not sure if you misspoke, saying that that would be a non-dual moment of mind, because that doesn't...
You're talking about that. Sometimes that you see a tree and just think
yeah.
tree. I didn't. If I said non-dual, that's not what I meant. I meant sometimes you see a tree and you just think tree, and then sometimes you might see a tree and actively assent to the false appearance of it as being distant and cut off and set up from its own side, and then and sometimes you might, if you're cultivating the path, see a tree and actually doubt or question or be suspicious about mm-hmm. or assume that it is incorrect, that it exists as it forcefully appears from outside. So this is a very small passage in Tsongkhapa's commentary on Chandrakirti's supplement to the Middle Way. But it turns out to be crucially important because he's saying, you know, of course, thought always has this quality of mistakenness because it mixes the appearing object with it. But it doesn't have to always be wrong, because and it's not always engaged in having as part of what it's actually conceiving this sense of true existence. Because if it did, then you'd have to go over to a different system. Because all of your every time you had any thought of anything, it would be an activation of a manifest form of the root of cyclic existence. You see what I'm saying? And so you have to be able to say that sometimes we think of things without this kind of active engagement of the assent. And then, assenting to the false appearance of things as true existence.
He talks about there's three ways of perceiving things. Mm-hmm. One is as truly existent. Mm-hmm. One is as empty or as illusion-alike. And then the third is as neither. Mm-hmm. So the neither is just, there's a tree.
Yeah.
Well, is that like having the appearance?
Yes.
Just having the appearance,
but without
the between that and
grasping. Yeah,
okay. So it does involve an additional mental factor,
right?
In other words,
The appearance of true existence is one thing, but the ignorance assents to that appearance and grasps that thing as truly existent.
Right. So what was being said here is the idea, like you're just walking along and you see something and you don't hardly even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to work with that a little bit in terms of, noticing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, getting really a distinction because whether I, walk past something and just kind of half notice it or walk past it and think, oh, isn't that nice? Either way, it looks like it is out there, exists without causes, whether or not there's somebody there, unchanging.
Yeah, that's the appearance.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But then there's also the thing of going along with the appearance. And I'll give you an example of, how I see the difference. I was on a flight one time, coming back from Tennessee. I had just gotten done teaching thought training, especially the five forces and cultivating bodhicitta and everything like that. And I had a seat, on the aisle, and it was a packed flight. And I went to my seat, and somebody was sitting in it, and I said, I think this is my seat, and, I can't forget exactly how the interchange went, but, this was definitely my seat. Forget what I had spent the weekend teaching. I did not want to sit in the middle seat on a long flight.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
There's the empty seat in the middle.
There's the empty seat in the middle that was her seat. And my seat was the aisle seat, but she was sitting in my seat, and I didn't want to sit in her seat because this was my seat. Okay? So before I got to that seat, there's a person sitting in that, because when you're in the front of the plane, you can't tell what row you're sitting in. So there's somebody sitting in that seat. So there's a seat. When I got there and I found out that it was my seat somebody was sitting in, that I held that seat a lot differently.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great example.
Yeah.
Because the seat was already appearing as though it existed from its own side. It's just that there wasn't any active engagement or assent to that because there wasn't anything at stake. I mean, the afflictions were coming into play. And
well, maybe that's where I'm getting mixed up because, I guess I wasn't thinking that assenting required the craving to come up in that strong way. I thought assenting just means it looks like it's out there and not just imputed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're saying assenting requires some additional. That's why I said additional.
Well, usually when you're assenting, the next step is affliction. I think you don't have the grasping at true existence so often just by itself without an affliction arising afterwards. Yeah, but of course, we have afflictions arising all the time.
Mm-hmm. Or
Can you say that again?
Yes.
Step after after the grasping, the affliction arises.
After
the grasping. The grasping is assenting that that appearance is correct.
So grasping and assenting are synonymous.
Yes.
Okay.
There's the appearance. I assent to it by saying, by grasping it as actually existing as it appears.
So you're saying then that when you were up front of the plane and you saw all these seats and you knew you wanted an aisle seat, but you didn't really. So you're saying you didn't at that point assent.
No.
To
no, there's a seat. There's a seat. That's so all.
It
doesn't matter.
I don't understand what the word assent means. Well, assent mean to me sounds like it's just. If I ask myself, I would agree with myself that it looks like it's out there and not dependent.
Yeah, and that's the appearance.
Yeah.
Then the assent is, it really exists that way.
Okay, so the assent is
there. There's some energy behind
it. It's like an active assent.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an active assent.
It's actually a factor of delusion. You know, mm-hmm. It's like the question is like, I was thinking about your example, and of course, you're putting the moment of delusion right before, another affliction related. But it almost feels like if you just look at the situation, that the other affliction would be coming up first or at the same time as the reification. Because if you didn't have something there that you were wanting, right, then what would suddenly cause this reification to pop up when before it wasn't there? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Before it was just.
Oh, I see.
You see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
There wasn't any.
Set up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like I almost think, well, you're having this sense of this as vividly being mine because there's already been a moment of craving, like in the instant before that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just telling you a different story.
Yeah. No, but actually, it's the craving of the this is real and there's a my in that.
Right.
You know,
it feels like that.
Yeah. I mean, there was definitely a my in that seat. And what's very interesting, when the flight landed and I stood up, that seat looked, I related to it entirely differently. You want to sit in it? Go ahead. Well, you're right. Everybody in the world can sit in that seat. It is no longer mine. I don't care about it.
Right.
You know? It's like how I related to that completely changed.
So I think I'm understanding then that we have appearances and then we reify them or grasp onto them. But I've lost the plot now. What was where were we going with that?
Oh, that after you reify it and you grasp onto it, if that's real, then there's also some real pleasure in there, or there's some real pain in there.
But we were saying this is a point in Tsongkhapa.
The original question, how we got onto this.
Oh, how we got onto it was because there's three ways of apprehending things.
And we use that clear one, the one that doesn't have the ascent in our analysis. Our ticket out of samsara, according to Tsongkhapa, is what you
think. It's really important because there. When we were doing Sakya yesterday, this thing where you first have to realize that things are empty of true existence, and then you have to stop thinking that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you have to stop thinking about that? Because as soon as you're thinking, this is empty, that is a reification. It's necessarily not just a mistaken consciousness with a correct thought. It's a wrong thought. It's part of the whole problem, because now instead of doing it about the seat, you're doing it about emptiness. And why are you doing it? Just because you're having a dualist. This dualistic thought is per se a part of the.
Yeah. So Sakya wouldn't say that there's these three ways of apprehending things. They'd say there's only two ways.
Right. Well, in the case of thought. I think, and it's not just Sakya, I think a lot of people are thinking that as soon as you have a thought, a conceptual thought
there's
and then there's grasping, because there's grasping at some sign, some reified characteristic of the object that the mind holds on to, identifies, picks out, and uses to create the internal representation, you know, the image that stands for the object in the mind. I it seems to be like that's the idea, is that they all take it that like Buddhists don't have conceptual thought, and that's and we do, and we're miserable and they're not, and so it seems pretty clear that that's a big part of the problem. And you can see, because it's like, this is the way the mind is like grasping at its object. So that as soon as you have a mind that's like conceptual mind that's grasping, it has to be a mind that's grasping at its object, and therefore it has to be something that gotten rid of. And so, you see what I'm saying? Then you can't really say that a thought that realizes emptiness is where you want to go.
Well, they would say that's a step.
Right, it's
you
a
have
step.
To get that. That then right. You have to release it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah.
The thing that's so kind of terrifying to the selfing is that the mind works so quick and not really aware of it. I had that thing with Judith and I were in the same room, and I had gone in there first, and I just first looked at two beds, and then I said, I'm more familiar with this bed, it's mine. So I put my jammies and my sheets and everything, you know, and then I went out and I came in, and Judith had done the same thing.
On the same bed?
I made my bed. She had claimed she had taken my bed. And I mean, it was like somebody had just come up and threw a dog pie in my face. I couldn't believe how quickly. I mean, it was just... You know, and I was kind of shocked because we weren't talking, fortunately. But I was absolutely amazed at how fast and violent that mind was.
Yeah.
And then as I, you know, as we went through our little thing, and then when we went to bed, and I thought, well, this bed's better than that one anyway. I was absolutely shocked, you know, at what was going on in here, you know. But you just don't, it's just almost impossible to catch.
Yeah.
Catch that. I mean, it's just like this cobra that just...
In my defense. I had no indication anybody was in that room, because I'm used to, you know, things had just kind of moved around and blankets being left. And my only comment as I was making my bed was, oh, look, they even put sheets here. Anyway, somebody else might be there, but I thought, oh, no, yeah, the room's changing. Yeah, and then there were jammies.
Maybe we better stop talking.
Yeah, the whole thing was just the shock of how quickly that all transpired.
Yeah.
Within just, I mean, less than a second.
Right.
Nanosecond.
And that's exactly how it is, and how difficult it is to even recognize the afflictions when they're there. You know, let alone kind of trace the origin of what were we thinking before that led to this affliction. And that's why we find ourselves in relationships and go, how in the world did I get here? Or we find ourselves saying something and say, shut up. Or, you know, because we just aren't completely oblivious.
Well, and then what was amazing to me, because I immediately knew that I was incorrect, that it was an incorrect assumption, because obviously it's not my bed. My bed's back home. but I couldn't get that wrathful thing, that clinging wrathful thing, you know, that said mine. It was like, I knew that it wasn't mine, but what mine had created couldn't be dislodged as quickly as it appeared.
Right.
And that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
Okay, I see that.
Yeah. And yet when you leave the abbey, you won't care what
that... Well, even that night when I got in the other bed and went, well, this is a better bed anyway. I just, it was so nice to have all this transpire in front of us because I could watch it. I didn't watch it. And because there was a part of the mind that says, this is incorrect behavior. You're way out of line. But it was just determined. Whatever that it is, I was shocked.
They, at Insight Meditation Center, they call it Vipassana Vendetta. people are in silence and then they develop, understanding who their enemy is. And then they get to watch how their mind is doing that.
So is the assenting always accompanied by an affliction?
The assenting is the self-grasping ignorance.
Okay, that's the ignorance.
Yeah.
And then there's another affliction.
Then that triggers, that acts as the basis for anger or attachment or whatever.
The assenting is self-grasping ignorance.
Yeah.
So what's the appearance?
The appearance is a... It's just the appearance. The appearance is a cognitive obscuration. The assenting is an afflictive obscuration. Okay?
I knew my story would make this today.
What's interesting, when I have those kinds of experiences, especially when I think I'm over that particular affliction, it's a really good reminder for me that... The seeds, that the karmic seeds that I have, because sometimes there's that delusion that think, okay, I've gone through that 150 times, I'm over it, I'm pure, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But just for me, that's the place where setting my motivation or practicing or working on something when I think I'm over it, it is that reminder that there are these latencies.
Yes.
And I have no idea how many of those latencies are, but reminded of them often enough.
There's one mental factor that sometimes it's translated as complacence and sometimes as haughtiness. And that's it.
I have a question about appearances, because it seems like in the way that we might be talking about it, as if these appearances are there from the very moment that we're born.
Mm-hmm, they are.
That is hard for me to understand, because it would seem to me like babies don't have very good vision yet.
Oh.
And that later we're taught what's in what category. Like they put, apples out and there's a book in there, and you have to pick out that the book is the wrong one. And it seems like you have to learn it in a way.
Yeah. A lot of this is learned quite definitely, because babies don't have good vision, and they don't even recognize their own cry as their own cry. They think it's from somebody else, and they get scared, But still, babies, although they don't have the intricate conceptualization that we do, that can make so many, categories and things like that, still, the way things just appear, there is an external world. And there's red and there's blue, and they don't put all those things in together to make a
complex object.
Yeah. But they still can distinguish those things, and those things are out there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so conception, it's a tricky word, because we usually think of conception as something very gross. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's I think much more subtle.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking about the difference between just having the appearance and having a grasping appearance. Sometimes it would seem that it's so subtle, this moment of grasping, that you couldn't even discern when you flick. So how much of the day do you think we're actually just with the appearance, and how much do you think we're really grasping at it?
Well, I can't give you a percentage thing,
but
put it this way, as soon as we are noticing that object and thinking about what it can do for or against me, There's grasping.
I asked a question earlier today about the other traditions or practice of meditation earlier in the studies, but I think it was really grounded in just the confusion of where practicing meditation comes along, and and not thinking necessarily of meditation as a view, but just in terms of, it seems like when we talk about shamatha, that it cultivates this like amazing power of the responsiveness, where we can then apply our mind to virtue constantly all day and all night without any problem. Mm-hmm. And so that would be very beneficial for cultivating not just the view, but also renunciation, bodhicitta. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if it's like this kind of magic power, unlimited energy of virtue, why don't we cultivate it earlier?
Okay, so why don't we, if shamatha is so incredibly important and gives you the power to understand things, well, why don't we cultivate it right from the very get-go? I think the reason is because of the danger of getting stuck in the bliss of shamatha, and also the fact that we are not really appropriate vessels to generate shamatha at the beginning of the path, because when our ethical conduct is all over the place, it's going to be very difficult to, generate shamatha. When we don't have the mindfulness and introspective awareness just of our general gross actions to discern what to do and what not to do, how are we going to have mindfulness and introspective awareness that are strong enough to stay on the object of meditation and know when we've gotten off? Yeah, because those two mental factors are quite important. And, they're on a much subtler level when you're developing concentration than when you're doing ethical conduct. Yeah. So I think, we have to really... shamatha is very good and it's important, but let's create the causes to get shamatha. Yeah, and it's not just sitting on the cushion. Yeah, we sometimes think, if I just sit on the cushion, and if I just do retreat, I can get shamatha. But that's not exactly it. There's a lot of causes and conditions that we need to cultivate first. I mean, maybe you can cultivate all those sitting on the cushion, but maybe you could do it faster if you weren't. Yeah?
But it still is like 40 years of study or 15 years of study or 10 years of study?
It's not laid out like that. It's really quite individual. Very individual. Yeah? Because we all come in with different, seeds from previous lives and different temperaments and different interests, and some people are really interested in the view and not so interested in shamatha, and some people are interested in shamatha and not in the view, and some people want to generate renunciation and other people don't. People are really different. So, I mean, that's the whole thing about the skill of the Buddha, to be able to find a way to communicate with everybody. And it's not laid out, you have to do two years and 5 months of this kind of practice, measuring so many minutes a day and achieve such and such results, and then you go on to the next step. It's not like that.
So then how do we decide, though?
You start at the beginning, and if the beginning is very easy and very natural, then you just go on to the next step.
But if the beginning is different in different lineages, or...
The beginning isn't different in the different lineages. It's very much the same. This is, the basic Lamrim meditations.
Yeah?
If you read Jewel Ornament of Liberation or Words of My Precious Teacher, all these things, the initial practices are very much the same.
You have to look really hard in those books to find... like little points of disagreement when they come to the part about the view. and the rest of everything is.
You mean about the method?
Yeah. When they come to the view part, even a lot of that is similar, is what I meant. But then that's where you can find a few differences. But in the other parts, they're the same.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just kind of start, and you know, if you have a real appreciation, strong appreciation from this about the preciousness of your life, day and night, and you every morning you wake up and you naturally think, you know, I could die today or I might die today, then you know something about what you're ready to do. But if you wake up in the morning and you think, oh, yeah, what do I have to do today? Oh, yeah, my day to do the altar. I better get up. then you know that you have a little bit more work at the beginning of the path to do. So, yeah. I mean, it's the same way. If you know, you every time you see chocolate cake, or you see, you know, somebody who, you know, normally would be sexually attracted to you, and you have absolutely no interest in them, no matter what situation you see that person in, then okay, maybe you've developed real renunciation. But you know, if that person isn't attractive to you because you have a bellyache, that's not renunciation.
That's gas.
What did you say?
Yeah, that's gas.
So it's just, I mean, it's always this thing we just, and this I think is the real value of study, is because you read this and then you compare your mind to it. Mm-hmm. And then you know what okay, I've accomplished that, or in my case, I haven't accomplished any of it, you know. But yes, you just look at it. You know, and then you don't have to get, oh, I had this incredible vision, and you know, this tingly feeling, and, you know, Chenrezig appeared to me, and the earth shook, and I think I must have bodhicitta. You know? You don't get into that way of ascertaining where you are in the practice. You look and see, you know, do I feel the way this describes? Yeah? That's much easier. Take some acid and then you all have all these grandiose appearances. I must have had really good imprints from my previous life.
it really kind of amazed me how, like you were saying, that we all have certain things that we're attracted to. And I was talking just about the Buddha nature, mm-hmm. and I realized that I have the enigma concept of Buddha nature, but I don't know where I got it, you know, because all I've ever been around is Galupa. But then I thought, you know, I've picked up other magazines, I picked up other books, I don't know what they were, mm-hmm. but I must have seen something, mm-hmm. you know, that I really liked about that. Mm-hmm. And then further, you guys were talking about, and with me, it just made it seem a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. You know, if yeah. the Buddha nature was there, and we just had to get rid of all the crap and all the other stuff. You know, but it was amazing. Our minds are very tricky.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not, sometimes it doesn't have anything to do whether it makes any sense or not. I like that better than the other one, whether it makes sense or not.
Right.
That was one thing.
Yeah, I'm very convinced that we choose what we believe according to what emotionally makes us feel good. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is, I think, why Tsongkhapa's emphasis on logic and reasoning is so important is that it makes us go past, you know, what feels good to me. I have to actually examine if what I'm thinking is true or not. Just to give you a little example, again relating to Manjushri, you know, when I was thinking, I'm so used to kind of coming up in the evening and I brush my teeth and Manju's in the room, you know, and I always stop to pet him. I bow to the Buddha and then I stop to pet Manju, or he's sitting at the top of the stairs and you have to pay your tax, you know, petting him. And he's not, you know, and that's not going to happen again. And then, you know, somehow this having some real strong significance for my mind that, oh, this is not going to happen again. And, you know, some emotion coming about that. And then stopping and saying, yeah, it's not going to happen again, so. So. You know, in other words, here I am grasping at this thing is so true, and, you know, this pattern and my kitty and, you know, and, okay, he's not going to be there, so. So I still bow to the Buddha, I still brush my teeth, I don't pet him. But what I do is, when I think of when that thought comes up, is then I train my mind to say, okay, Manju, have a good rebirth. Yeah. Instead of going to, oh, it's not going to happen again. You know, as if it's like some meaningful thing to pet your cat every evening. I mean, is that meaningful in the course of the universe? Is that something of intrinsic value? It's much more valuable to wish him, you know, that he meets the Dharma in a future life. Isn't it? Yeah? So if I notice that coming up, then replace it. So not just following whatever I happen to believe or whatever my emotion happens to be into at that particular moment.
Yeah? You know that poem by Issa, the Pure Land Japanese Buddhist poet, supposedly written after one of his children had died of smallpox, and he wrote the poem, "The world of dew is indeed a world of dew, and yet, mm-hmm. And it's like, well, the Buddha's teaching the world is a dew, and then he's like, okay, I really realize it's right. Everything is just vanishing like dew. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, it's like, but even understanding vividly how forcefully that really is existentially mm-hmm. true, it doesn't mean that I'm not hurting over, you know, it doesn't just suddenly make it okay just to understand that things are important.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the level of understanding, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, because, it's, you know, it's discordant with our sense that things ought to continue like them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if you're really, really familiar with impermanence and have a realization of it, then I think it'd probably be different. Better be different, otherwise what are we doing? You know? If it's not different, then we're really sunk. Yeah.